Ezekiel chapter 22. Moreover, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Now, thou son of man, wilt thou judge? Will thou judge the bloody city? Yea, thou shalt show her all her abominations. Then say thou, Thus saith Yahweh God, the city sheddeth blood in the midst of it, that her time may come, and maketh idols against herself to defile herself. Thou art become guilty in thy blood that thou hast shed, and hast defiled thyself in thine idols which thou hast made, and thou hast caused thy days to draw near, and art come even unto thy years. Therefore have I made thee a reproach unto the heathen, and a mocking to all countries. Those that be near and those that be far from thee shall mock thee, which art infamous and much vexed. Behold, the princes of Israel, every one were in thee to their power to shed blood. In thee have they set light by father and mother. In the midst of thee have they dealt by oppression with the stranger. In thee have they vexed the fatherless and the widow. Thou hast despised mine holy things, and hast profaned my Sabbaths. In thee are men that carry tales to shed blood. In thee they eat upon the mountains. In the midst of thee they commit lewdness. In thee have they discovered their father's nakedness. In thee have they humbled her that was set apart for pollution. In one hath committed abomination with his neighbor's wife, and another hath lewdly defiled his daughter-in-law, and another thee hath humbled his sister, his father's daughter. End of verse 11.
Sounds like today.
Yeah.
It just shows the degree to which pagan Judah degenerated. I really believe that Ezekiel chapter 22 recounts the sins of Judah, and Ezekiel chapter 23 is a divorce decree, but I'll talk about that more when we get to chapter 23, even though it doesn't use the language divorce or divorcement. It doesn't use that language. But it's just the extent of the sins. It's not about idolatry. It's about sex and defiling everything, basically.
Yeah, and carry tales. That's basically slander, what the Hebrew word is. It's slander to shed blood. And there's a lot of that these days.
Well, yes, there is. I mean, people just want to walk on each other and don't care what they say about each other.
And they don't care about the consequences that the other person will receive.
Right. They really don't.
Yeah, all the things they did in idolatry. Like, idolatry justified them committing all these shedding of blood and taking advantage of their kindred, because these idols have different laws than Yahweh has. Laws that they just made up themselves to follow their own lusts.
Yeah, Jews always promote revenge. It's in all of their novels and movies and stuff like that. They like the concept of revenge, and they promote it to white people.
Speaking about that, I took a screenshot today, but I forgot to post it. I don't think I posted it in the chat. I meant to. That this somebody posted basically an orthotard video in the chat last week. Maybe it was Catholics, maybe they were Orthodox. They were defending Mary worship and the Trinity. They were defending that. So I just left a one word comment on that account, and I said idolaters, period. That's all I said, and somebody thumbs up it. But somebody called Troll Patrol went on there and said, troll, calling me a troll, reported to YouTube for harassment and ignorance. So I left a reply to that, and now I see my reply is not there.
You've been ghost banned. I'm banned. I'm banned, so you're in the club now, Bill.
Yeah, like that's a lighter version of, slander. for bloodshed. I mean, but you actually have it in courtrooms. You have it in society in general, on all types of levels, where in the end, actually, it can get people killed. But it especially gets people to lose their jobs and their income these days, of course.
I'll put a link to the video in here, but I don't know if y'all are going to see my comment. And my reply is gone, and I got a screenshot of it.
Yeah, so they got rid of you.
But my original comment's still there.
Did you send a link?
I just put it in the forum window at the bottom.
No, in the comment.
No, I just sent a comment. Idolaters, that's all I said.
No, the second one.
No, no links.
I can see your comment, Bill.
Amazing. Do you see my reply? Because I don't.
I can see your first comment, then there's a highlighted reply by Troll Patrol. That's the idiot, right? Did you reply to him? Because there's nothing after that.
Yeah, I did reply to him. But yeah, my comment's not there.
Yeah, everything after your first comment, I think you're banned.
Scumbags.
Yep. I just noticed in verse... Oh, sorry, Bill. Who was that?
I'm just going to say I should go in on my other Google account and make another comment.
Yeah, and get that one banned too.
Yeah, but that one I hardly ever sign on to.
In verse 10, it says, "In thee have they discovered their father's nakedness. In thee have they humbled her that was set apart for pollution." She wasn't set apart to be polluted. She was set apart because she was menstruating. So she was set apart and someone's defiled her while she was menstruating. I think that's what verse 10 means. Humbled her that was set apart for pollution.
Yes, that means that they, right. They took a woman, they humbled her, right? That means they took her in sexual intercourse, even though she was menstruating.
So that's quite a grievous sin.
Yes.
Because it's been mentioned twice in Ezekiel now. All right, do you want me to go on with verse 12?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is all pretty cut and dry. I mean, there's not a whole lot to talk about, but it just recounts the gravity of their sins is pretty severe. And of course, we see all the same things being committed in our society today.
Verse 12, "In thee have they taken gifts to shed blood. Thou hast taken usury and increase, and thou hast greedily gained of thy neighbors by extortion, and hast forgotten me, saith Yahweh God. Behold, therefore, have I smitten mine hand out thy dishonest gain which thou hast made, and out thy blood which hath been in the midst of thee. Can thine heart endure, or can thine hands be strong in the days that I shall deal with thee? I, Yahweh, have spoken it and will do it. And I will scatter thee among the heathen and disperse thee in the countries, and will consume thy filthiness out of thee. And thou shalt take thine inheritance in thyself in the sight of the heathen. And thou shalt know that I am Yahweh. And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, the house of Israel is to me become dross, and they are brass and tin. All they are brass and tin and iron and lead in the midst of the furnace. They are even the dross of silver. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh God, because ye are all become dross, behold, therefore I will gather you into the midst of Jerusalem. As they gather silver and brass and iron and lead and tin into the midst of the furnace to blow the fire upon it, to melt it, so will I gather you in mine anger and in mine fury, and I will leave you there and melt you. Yeah, I will gather you and blow upon you in the fire of my wrath, and ye shall be melted in the midst thereof. As silver is melted in the midst of the furnace, so shall ye be melted in the midst thereof, and ye shall know that I, Yahweh, have poured out my fury upon you. And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, say unto her, thou art the land that is not cleansed, nor rained upon in the day of indignation. There is a conspiracy of her prophets in the midst thereof, like a roaring lion ravening the prey. They have devoured souls. They have taken the treasure and precious things. They have made her many widows in the midst thereof. Her priests have violated my law and have profaned mine holy things. They have put no difference between the holy and profane, neither have they showed difference between the unclean and the clean, and hid their eyes from my Sabbaths, and I am profaned among them. Oh, I may as well finish. Her princes in the midst thereof are like wolves ravening their prey to shed blood and to destroy souls, to get dishonest gain. Her prophets have daubed them with untempered mortar, seeing vanity and divining lies unto them, saying, thus saith Yahweh God, when Yahweh has not spoken. The people of the land have used oppression and excised robbery and have vexed the poor and needy. Yea, they have oppressed the stranger wrongfully. And I sought for a man among them that should make up the hedge and should stand in the gap before me for the land, that I should not destroy it, but I found none. Therefore have I poured out mine indignation upon them. I have consumed them with the fire of my wrath. Their own way have I recompensed upon their heads, saith Yahweh God.
That's a long allegory with all these base metals and more precious metals all gathered together and thrown in the same fire to be melted together. That's a pretty long allegory. It's like several verses.
And he's melting it all down, and there's nothing but dross. He's melting down Jerusalem, and it's all dross.
Right. So he's going to do the same thing to the people that he described of the metal. Her prophets have daubed them with untempered mortar. That they are the false prophets, of course. So what they're teaching the people has no substance to it in order to create a viable community. And in order to have a viable society, people have to have an education in their God and what's right and what's wrong.
That's exactly what the priests and ministers are doing today, and the pastors.
Right. It's been going on for years and years. Even when I was a child in the 60s, the churches still did teach decent morality, right? It was wrong to be a fag. It was a sin to be a fag. It was a sin to steal or do this or do that. I mean, most of the moral elements necessary are there. Race mixing was never really preached against, though, even though it didn't happen that often. It wasn't brought up in church. I mean, in Catholic Church, sex, fornication is sex outside of marriage, outside of Catholic marriage, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's talking about, you know, daubing the wall and the mortar. And later in the chapter, it's talking about standing in the gap. There was no man to stand in the gap. And there was no hedge. There was no man to make up a hedge. And earlier in Ezekiel, we had that same thing. The false prophets weren't securing the wall because they were using untempered mortar. So the wall was not strong. So they weren't protecting Jerusalem, the holy city, because the wall they were building was not, the teachings they were given were not securing the future of their city. I know.
We actually see it in Isaiah chapter 58, and I remember a podcast I did somewhere in the epistles of Paul, which was titled Repairers of the Breach. And in Isaiah chapter 58, we read, and They that shall be of thee shall build the old waste places. Thou shalt raise up the foundations of many generations, and thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of paths to dwell in. So what we see there is that the men who stand in a breach, or here, as it's translated, gap, and it should have been breach, it would have been better because it would have been easier to cross-reference to Isaiah 58. That them that stand in the gap, or the repairers of the breach, are those who try to bring the people back to their God, and by having them keep the commandments and obey the covenants, respect the covenants.
The watchmen used to stand along the wall, right, Bill? So Yahweh God is the true wall of the city. He's the true fortress of the city of Jerusalem. But at the same time, the watchmen are supposed to stand along the wall and guard the city, and, you know, stand in the gap and watch for the enemy.
Right.
It's also
right.
Got
the
that
people move away from God. They're creating that breach.
We also like to quote verse 26, her priests have violated my law and have profaned mine holy things. They have put no difference between the holy and profane, neither have they showed difference between the unclean and the clean. So we've got profane and holy and clean and unclean. And that's the same as today. We quote this verse all the time because the priest of today put no difference between unclean and clean and no difference between profane and holy. They don't even know the difference between holy and profane.
Right. They don't. They themselves don't know. It was my second part of my Philippians commentary.
Where you spoke about repairers of the breach.
Yes.
Who is the her that's being referred to?
You mean like her whoredoms, her neighbors? You mean that?
Okay, then yeah, it's referring to Jerusalem. Got it.
Yeah, the city.
Yeah, it would be good to cross-reference Ezekiel 22:25 to Isaiah 58:11. I don't have a paper Bible to do that, and I wouldn't ever find it again if I did. If I don't remember it, it's lost.
I'll write it down, 58:11. And Yahweh shall guide thee continually and satisfy thy soul in drought and make fat thy bones. Was it 58:11?
58:12, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. And they that shall be of thee shall build the old waste places. Thou shalt raise up the foundations of many generations, and they shall be called the repairer of the breach.
Raising the foundations of many generations should probably be cross-referenced to Malachi chapter 4, and turning the hearts of the fathers to the children, the hearts of the children to the fathers. For real.
Yeah, because Yahweh is faithful to 1,000 generations.
I'm liable to forget that one day, too.
I don't think so. There's some pretty good cross-references.
Well, I remember years ago reading Ezekiel chapter 23 and basically recognizing that was, without using the word divorce, that was the divorce decree against Judah. I mean, it's alluded to in Jeremiah. Yeah, you know, okay, let me put it this way. That there's an old Shi'i heresy that a lot of you probably never even heard of, that claims that Israel was divorced, but Judah was never divorced, meaning that Yahweh still has a relationship with the Jews because they were never divorced. And this, of course, comes through British Israel and their boneheaded idea that the Jews are Israel. And they make their excuse for the Jews, the British Israel people, by claiming that Judah was never divorced. And Clifton handled this in the early years quite a few times. In Jeremiah, in, I got to go looking for it now, which window I had it up in. And it's just not coming because I got three copies of, here it is. I found it. Three copies of Bible Works open because I didn't want to disturb my Genesis commentary. In Jeremiah chapter 33, that divorce is alluded to, where it says, "Considerest thou not what this people have spoken, saying, the two families which Yahweh has chosen, he has even cast them off?" So that's basically admitting that Judah is cast off as well as Israel, right? And that's the overall context of that section of Jeremiah chapter 33. So I don't remember when, maybe 5, 6, 8 years ago, because I did remember mentioning this in a podcast or outlining it in a podcast. I realized that Ezekiel chapter 3 is basically the divorce decree for Judah, even though that word is not mentioned in the chapter.
Well, I will read chapter 23 now then.
Yeah.
"The word of Yahweh came again unto me, saying, Son of man, there were two women, the daughters of one mother, and they committed whoredoms in Egypt. They committed whoredoms in their youth. There were their breasts pressed, and they bruised their teats of their virginity. And the names of them were Alo, La, the elder, and O, Aholiba, her sister, and they were mine, and they bare sons and daughters. Thus were their names. Samaria is Aloha, is Ahola, and Jerusalem Aholiba. And Ahola played the harlot when she was mine, and she doted on her lovers, on the Assyrians, her neighbors, which were clothed with blue, captains and rulers, all of them desirable young men, horsemen riding upon horses. Thus she committed her whoredoms with them, with all them that were the chosen men of Assyria, and with all on whom she doted. With all their idols she defiled herself. Neither left her whoredoms brought from Egypt, for in her youth they lay with her. And they bruised the breasts of her virginity and poured their whoredom upon her. Wherefore I have delivered her into the hands of her lovers, into the hands of the Assyrians, upon whom she doted. These discovered her nakedness. They took her sons and her daughters and slew her with the sword. And she became famous among women, for they had executed judgment upon her. And when her sister Aholiba saw this, she was more corrupt in her inordinate love than she, and in her whoredoms more than her sister in her whoredoms. She doted upon the Assyrians, her neighbors, captains and rulers, clothed most gorgeously, horsemen riding upon horses, all of them desirable young men. Then I saw that she was defiled, that they took both one away."
Sometimes that language is confusing, where it says inordinate love. It comes from a word which just means lustfulness. In her lustfulness. So that could be confusing. A lot of people probably don't know that what inordinate means. A lot of common readers, they probably don't. Ahola is, of course, Israel, and Aholibar is Judah. And Ahola means her own tent, evidently. But Aholiba means woman of the tent. So they're very similar words. Two sisters from the same mother, the mother being Israel, of course. So we have Israel and Judah being compared here. And after Aholah was punished for her iniquity, Aholibah went off and committed even greater iniquity.
And so that's that they took both one way. So the one way they both took is the way of whoredom.
Yes. Yes, Samaria and Jerusalem are Aholah and Aholibah. It actually says that explicitly in verse 4.
All right, should I continue with verse 14?
Why not?
And that she increased her whoredoms, for when she saw men portrayed upon the wall, the images of the Chaldeans portrayed with vermilion, girded with girdles upon their loins, exceeding in dye attire upon their heads, all of them princes to look to, after the manner of the Babylonians of Chaldea, the land of their nativity. And as soon as she saw them with her eyes, she doted upon them, and sent messengers unto them in Chaldea. And the Babylonians came to her into the bed of love, and they defiled her with their whoredom, and she was polluted with them, and her mind was alienated from them. So she discovered her whoredoms and discovered her nakedness. Then my mind was alienated from her, like as my mind was alienated from her sister.
Well, which right there tells us that Judah was divorced, that Judah was being treated the same way by God as Israel had been treated. That's all I wanted to squeeze in there.
Yep. Yet she multiplied her whoredoms in calling to remembrance the days of her youth, wherein she had played the harlot in the land of Egypt. For she doted upon their paramours, whose flesh is as the flesh of asses, and whose issue is like the issue of horses. Thus thou calledest to remembrance the lewdness of thy youth in bruising thy teats by the Egyptians for the paps of thy youth. Therefore, O Aholibah, thus saith Yahweh God, behold, I will raise up thy lovers against thee from whom thy mind is alienated, and I will bring them against thee on every side. So why is her mind alienated from her lovers, Bill, and then God's mind is alienated from her?
Why is she
from whom thy mind is alienated? So it says that twice.
Oh, holy boss, thus saith Yahweh God, behold, I will raise up thy lovers against me from whom thy mind is alienated, and I will bring them against thee on every side. I can only imagine that that's the way a whore thinks, right? That she doesn't really love any of her lovers. She's just sleeping around. She's always plotting against her lovers and devising what she could get out of them. That's the only reason for whoredom. She doesn't actually love them.
Okay.
Let's see what the NASB has to say about that.
Become disgusted or alienated.
Behold, I will arouse your lovers against you from whom you were alienated, and I will bring them against you from every side. So they're turning on the whore. The lovers are turning on the whore. Because the whore never really loved any of them. She was coupling with them to see what she could get out of them. I mean, that's typical of a whore, isn't it?
Yes.
A gold-digging whore doesn't actually care about the men she's sleeping with. She only cares about what she could get out of them for herself. And I think that's what's being described here. There's some pretty graphic language here, just like we encountered a couple of weeks ago with the children of Israel laying down in the corners of every way, on the intersections of every way, and spreading their legs. I mean, whose flesh, her paramours, or her lovers, whose flesh is as the flesh of asses, that are hung like horses. And we say that today. I mean, we have that, oh, he's hung like a horse. I've heard that when I was a kid.
bruising and, thy teats, and the paps.
Yeah, and whose issue is like the issue of horses. So they had very high sperm counts, I gather.
And how do you bruise your teats, Bill, by the Egyptians, and what are the paps of thy youth? Should I ask these questions, or do you want me to check the dictionary?
Well, teats and paps are two different words for breasts, right?
Yeah, they're getting bruised. That it's doesn't
two
sound...
Synonyms. Two synonyms are used here for breasts.
Yeah, what are they doing?
That's the lewdness of her youth. Abusing herself. Which I guess fits in with the description of a whore who's actually giving herself away for free and abusing herself. So this, I believe, is the divorce decree of Judah, where Aholibah, which is represents Judah and Jerusalem, is going to be alienated just like Israel was alienated. And it says that several times. It uses that word alienated a couple of times, or words that mean alienated several times here.
Yeah, I see it. Can I ask one more thing, though, Bill? At verse 14, it says, then she carried her prostitutions even further. Go back to KJV. Then she increased her whoredoms, for when she saw men portrayed upon the wall, the images of the Chaldeans portrayed with vermilion.
As soon as she saw them with her eyes, she doted upon them and sent messengers unto them into Chaldea. And the Babylonians came to her in a bed of love, and they defiled her with their whoredom. Yeah, you know, this process began with Hezekiah. And when Babylonians came to see Hezekiah, he brought them into the temple and into the palace, and he showed off all the gold and silver to them and all the riches of Jerusalem. And that's when it started. And Hezekiah was admonished by that. He was admonished for that from Yahweh.
Yeah, I see that, yeah. In the NLT, it has, then she carried her prostitution even further. She fell in love with pictures that were painted on a wall, pictures of Babylonian military officers. So they must have had some sort of exchange with the Babylonians, and the Israelites are seeking out the Babylonians to...
It's in 2 Kings chapter 20. At that time... Beredak Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present unto Hezekiah, for he had heard that Hezekiah had been sick. And Hezekiah hearkened unto them and showed them all the house of his precious things, the silver and the gold, and the spices and the precious ointment, and all the house of his armor, and all that was found in his treasures. There was nothing in his house, nor in all his dominion, that Hezekiah showed them not. Then came Isaiah the prophet unto King Hezekiah, and said unto him, what said these men, and from whence came they? And Hezekiah said, they are come from a far country, even from Babylon. And he, meaning Isaiah, said, what have they seen in thine house? And Hezekiah answered, all the things that are in mine house they have seen. There is nothing among my treasures that I have not showed them. And Isaiah said unto Hezekiah, hearken the word of Yahweh. Behold, the days come. Now, these words are being spoken right around 702 to 700 BC, right? Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and all that which thy fathers have laid up in store under this day shall be carried into Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith Yahweh. So that's when this started. And now we're seeing the other end of it, perhaps 110 years later.
110 years, eh?
About, approximately, give or take a couple.
All right, I'll continue with verse 23.
Yeah, Sheldon, going on in 2 Kings chapter 20, I believe, is that Hezekiah is looking for allies against the Assyrians. And here come the Babylonians, and the Babylonians are probably looking for allies against the Assyrians. That would be my first guess at what's actually going on in 2 Kings chapter 20.
And the Assyrians were the first lover. So the first lover has like abandoned them and is against them. So now they're looking for allies against their first lover. And then they'll go to the next lover, I'm guessing.
It's in that same chapter that in 2 Kings chapter 20, where the promise of Yahweh is that he would defend Jerusalem against the hand of the Assyrian. Yet Hezekiah shows the Babylonians kindness when the Babylonians evidently were reaching out to him for an ally against the Assyrians. So it's in that same chapter.
Yeah, so they're whoring around.
That's definitely what's going on. So Hezekiah, even though Yahweh promised that he'd defend Jerusalem, Hezekiah's being kind and receiving these Babylonians and showing them all his great treasures and basically bragging. So Yahweh told Hezekiah that everything was going to be given over to the Babylonians because he did that.
It's like one of those women who has an abusive boyfriend, like their ex-boyfriend was always abusive and they're always looking for a new boyfriend to help save them from their ex-boyfriend. It's kind of like that.
Yeah, well, the children of Israel were told to be a separate people. They weren't supposed to have alliances or dealings with any of these nations. None of them.
They're supposed to trust Yahweh, and instead they're whoring around.
Right. And they were told not to have alliances with any of these nations. Even though they were other, quote-unquote, Adamic nations, they were told to stay separate from them. And that's why one of the major sins, I think it's in Hosea, one of the major sins of Israel was international trade. Because they were supposed to be a separate people.
Yeah, because international trade was basically taking what Yahweh gives you and whoring it out to, selling it off to other nations. So international trade was like taking your husband's property and just giving it all away.
But it's also when you recognize a foreign nation or a foreign people, an alien people, let me put it that way, you also recognize their gods. You accept their gods. Well, when you recognize and accept a Chinaman into your home, you're accepting his gods as well. And you're going to set aside the commandments of your God to please him and his God when you deal with him. That's what you're doing.
I'll read verse 23. The Babylonians and the Chaldeans, Pekod and Shoah and Koah and all the Assyrians with them, all of them desirable young men, captains and rulers, great lords and renowned, all of them riding upon horses, and they shall come against thee with chariots, wagons and wheels, and with an assembly of people, which shall set against thee buckler and shield and helmet round about, and I will set judgment before them, and they shall judge thee according to their judgments, and I will set my jealousy against thee, and they shall deal furiously with thee. They shall take away thy nose and thine ears, and thy remnant shall fall by the sword. They shall take away thy sons and thy daughters, and thy residue shall be devoured by the fire. They shall also strip thee out of thy clothes and take away thy fair jewels. Thus will I make thy lewdness to cease from thee, and thy whoredom brought from the land of Egypt, so that thou shalt not lift up thine eyes unto them, nor remember Egypt any more. For thus saith Yahweh God, behold, I will deliver thee into the hand of them whom thou hatest, into the hand of them from whom thy mind is alienated, and they shall deal with thee hatefully, and shall take away all thy labor, and shall leave thee naked and bare, and the nakedness of thy whoredom shall be discovered, both thy lewdness and thy whoredoms. I will do these things unto thee, because thou hast gone a whoring after the heathen, and because thou art polluted with their idols. Thou hast walked in the way of thy sister, therefore will I give her cup into thine hand. Thus saith Yahweh God, thou shalt drink of thy sister's cup, deep and large. Thou shalt be laughed to scorn and had in derision, and containeth much. Thou shalt be filled with drunkenness and sorrow, with the cup of astonishment and desolation, with the cup of thy sister Samaria. Thou shalt even drink it and suck it out, and thou shalt break the sherds thereof and pluck off thine own breast, for I have spoken it, saith Yahweh God.
So that is another, basically, another indication that this is a divorce decree against Judah.
The same cup that thy sister got, you're getting it.
Yes. This was important when we were debating. It's not important in our circles, because I think we all know better. But when we were debating this years ago with British Israel people, I mean, they still refuse to acknowledge it. Because it makes them rethink the Jewish question, and that makes them uncomfortable.
I guess for a long time they got a pass because they still respected the Jews.
Yeah.
And they don't want to lose that pass, maybe. Anyone else got a comment on this part? Yeah, this is pretty standard. I'll keep reading then. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh God, because thou hast forgotten me and cast me behind thy back, therefore bear thou also thy lewdness and thy whoredoms. Yahweh said moreover unto me, Son of man, wilt thou judge Aholah and Aholibah? Yea, declare unto them their abominations, that they have committed adultery, and blood is in their hands, and with their idols they have they committed adultery, and have also caused their sons, whom they bear unto me, to pass for them through the fire, to devour them. Moreover, this they have done unto me. They have defiled my sanctuary in the same day, and have profaned my Sabbaths. For when they had slain their children to their idols, then they came the same day into my sanctuary to profane it. And lo, thus have they done in the midst of mine house. And furthermore, that ye have sent for men to come from far, unto whom a messenger was sent, and lo, they came, for whom thou didst watch thyself, paintedst thy eyes, and deckedst thyself with ornaments, and sattest upon a stately bed, and a table prepared before it, whereupon thou hast set mine incense and mine oil, and a voice of a multitude being at ease was with her, and with the men of the common sort were brought Sabians from the wilderness, which put bracelets upon their hands and beautiful crowns upon their heads. Then said I unto her that was old in adulteries, Will thou now commit whoredoms with her, and she with them? Yet they went in unto her as they go in unto a woman that playeth the harlot. So went they in unto Aholah and unto Aholibah, the lewd women, and the righteous men, they shall judge them after the manner of adulteresses, and after the manner of women that shed blood, because they are adulteresses, and blood is in their hands. For thus saith Yahweh God, I will bring up a company upon them, and will give them to be removed and spoiled. And the company shall stone them with stones, and dispatch them with their swords, and they shall slay their sons and their daughters, and burn up their houses with fire. End of chapter 23. I've missed it. I had to scroll down. Sorry about that. Thus will I cause lewdness to cease out of the land, that all women may be taught not to do after your lewdness, and they shall recompense your lewdness upon you, and ye shall bear the sins of your idols, and ye shall know that I am Yahweh God.
That's funny. I was just starting to wonder about that. End of chapter 23.
End of Now it's the end.
That's funny. I mean, this is, I mean, it's kind of cut and dry. There's not a whole lot to discuss here. I mean, all of the elements of whoredom are there, right? I mean, departure from the law, sexual immorality, and intercourse with these other nations. And for that, we're whores. Collectively, we're a whore, right? So we're whores today and we're whores then. Because we don't learn from history, ever. We never, ever learn from history.
And like you said, Bill, like it says in verse 41, and a table prepared before it whereupon thou hast set mine incense and mine oil. So they basically took God's incense and oil and gave it to these other nations.
Well, right. Schools. That's what we have to understand. And this is what people don't understand. I mean, I don't care if you have a job and you go out and make a little money and buy things and you have things. If you can do that, you have to understand that it's Yahweh God that gave you the ability to do that. And he's basically letting you have his things. Because he's given those things to you. Everything you have, he's given to you. That's how we should think. That's how we should always think. And if you disobey him and fall out of obedience and into sin, then he's going to give those things to somebody else. And that's an example all through scripture.
It also says like the purpose of all these punishments is so that women may be taught not to do the same as what you've done. So there's a national lesson there that we, if we live like whores and our nation departs from the law of Yahweh, then our nation is just going to be destroyed by whoredoms, like Hosea says.
Right. And it's inevitable, and there's no doubt that it's going to happen, because no unjust, sinful nation can possibly be durable or viable. It's just not possible.
I'm going to ask you one more thing, Bill. These Sabians from the wilderness that they brought into whore with and that put bracelets on their hands, are these Arabs? Are these Sabians Arabs that they're bringing in?
Yeah, you know, the word Arabia first appears in the time of Solomon. And that indicates to me that the tribes, if you go back into the period of Joshua and Judges, the lands to the east were distinguished by names like Midian and Cush and Havilah and Amalek and Moab. But from the time of Solomon, this general word Arabia started to appear in scripture and in history, of course. And Arab does mean something that's mixed. So they may not have been like mingling with niggers yet, but evidently those tribes that had formerly had their own distinct parts of Arabia, of places where they dwelt, the descendants of Peleg, the descendants of Joktan, the descendants of Abraham's sons with Keturah, and the descendants of Lot, along with several Canaanite tribes and Esau, right, that they must have started becoming mixed up at some point, where that word Arabia was used to describe a much wider area of that land. So now it's 350 years after the time of Solomon. So the Sabians, that they may have still been a distinct tribal group by that time, But the general connotation of Arabia would have included them as well, because they were all pagans. They had no law. So they had no moral proclivity not to mix. And we can see in several places in Genesis, the proclivity to mix that was held by the Canaanites and the other tribes, the Rephaim, the Canaanites, had a proclivity to mix. So all of those tribes that didn't have the law, that had no proclivity not to mix, no reason not to mix or intermarry or intermingle, yeah, they would have become Arabs, in the sense that their tribal identification or their tribal genealogy came from more than one tribe. They would have become Arabs. Now it was much later that they began to mix with Negroes to bring the Nubians in, to import Nubians as slaves was much later. I don't think that was happening this early. I mean, it may have been in some small degree, but I don't think so.
The definition for is saying drunkard.
Basabian.
Yeah.
Now, a Sabian is actually a descendant of Sheba.
Let me pull back up again. So it's coming from
Seba, Genesis chapter 10, verse 7. Cush, Seba, Havilah, and Sabta. So we have Seba as a son of Cush. And that, I believe, are the Sabians here. But there is also a Sheba.
Yeah, it's saying that's coming from Saba.
So there's a Seba and there's a Sheba, and there's always been confusion as to which one could be who, like the Queen of Sheba.
They're saying that it's from Strong's Hebrew 5436.
Yeah, the spellings are slightly different, but not much.
Or Hebrew 5433.
Well, 5436 is from the patronym 5434, which is Seba, Genesis chapter 10, verse 7, a son of Cush.
So the fact that they're bringing them in from the wilderness, could that indicate which one is meant, Bill? Because they're coming in from the wilderness, so you'd think that could be like...
Yeah, but they were probably descendants of Cush, but that don't mean they were unmixed. There was also a Sheba that descended from Joktan, but that's spelled a little differently, with a shin instead of a samak.
Microphone activated.
Yeah, they're descendants of Ham, Joe, but that doesn't mean that they're not mixed with Canaanites to become Arabs.
I see.
Maybe the descendants of Ham were known to be drunkards.
You guys, I stepped away. You guys talk about the Sabians?
Yeah.
Well, Seba means drink, right? It actually means you drink, according to Strong's.
They were known as star worshippers, too. They had a very strong cult worship of the stars.
Are those the same Sabians? Or are you talking about the Sabines and the Cathars?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
I'm talking about these ones here.
This is long before the time of the Cathars, man.
Yeah, the Cathars
like
are thousands of years off.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about these guys.
Huh. Where it does mention about there being star worshippers?
Oh, no, that's just if you look into them, like their history. It's not mentioned in the Bible, but maybe it is. I don't recall.
Does it give a genealogy of them?
Of the Sabians?
Yeah.
I didn't read a ton of stuff on them. I just remember that they were known for star worship, and they were from Arabia. I believe South Arabia. And there were some in Mesopotamia too. So I think that there were two significant communities of them.
Do you remember what book you read that in, or?
No, I don't. I don't even think I read a book that they were in.
I don't think the name is known to Greek historians, right? I seriously doubt it.
I mean,
but basically the ancient Israelites were bringing in men from the wilderness and fornicating with them. It's pretty crazy. Because in old Israel, you had, under the old order, you had Israel, and then outside Israel, you had this wilderness. And in the wilderness, there were Arabs and wild animals and all sorts of things.
Okay, why is it crazy if today just about every country in Europe and America are bringing in the lowest scum fucking niggers and Pakistanis and shitbags from all these Muslim and African countries and fornicating with them?
From the wilderness, from the outer edges of civilization, they find these people and they bring them in, and then they fornicate with them. It's
it's the exact same thing we're doing today.
Yeah, it's like they're going out of their way to find these people. It's like the Star Trek thing, like they have to find other planets of people to fornicate with, because you just can't keep it with your own people and, you know, and, you know, have a nice wife that's flesh of thy flesh and bone of thy bone. They have to go, you know, search the solar system for other aliens to mix with.
Okay, but isn't that what the German women in the airport that are welcoming immigrants are doing? They're doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's like a theme of our society or something.
Yeah, they're waiting for some hormone-enriched young nigger to get off a plane so they could fuck the shit out of them, basically, to put it bluntly.
Yeah, and it's because of the behavior of the white men, because the white men are not acting like men. They're not obeying their God. And so they search out men who are still represent something, even though they don't even know what the hell their religions are or what they mean. At least they believe in it, and they have a set of rules, and they treat their women like women, and they want to be treated like men. Whereas here, it's a mix. Like men are not really treating women like women.
Here it's a mix, but when you try to treat a woman like a woman, you end up in divorce court.
Yeah.
Well, but also it depends on the definition. I don't know if we're talking about the two same things.
How can a nigger lose its identity when it's just a beast, whereas we have lost our identity because we're more than beasts, so we're not really acting as men anymore, but they're still acting as what they are.
Yeah, like, I mean, he's not acting dominant and putting her in her place, which is below him as his wife.
That's my point. If an American male tries to do that to an American female, he's going to end up in divorce court.
I don't know. I mean, I think we need more.
I agree with Phil.
Yeah, but I mean, that's because the way it's begun in the first place, right? He begins the relationship making her his equal. Right, in all matters.
Yeah, it's framed from the very start.
And that's when the mistake
in the West
happens.
Every relationship is framed that way.
Okay, but I'm just saying that these women want these guys here because of the way men are acting. It's our fault as a group. We were the ones who turned our back on our God and not obeyed him.
But I agree that it's the men who are primarily to blame for the condition of today's society. I agree with that. But the man who does try to do the right thing usually ends up getting himself in more trouble today.
I guess. Yeah, I mean, I'm not really arguing that. I know what you mean. But it's not really a solvable problem other than just returning to Yahweh's ways, right?
Yeah, so, only God can solve this problem. We can.
Right. Yeah.
It's not like an individual man can change society and set it back on Yahweh's laws, which is what you actually need to fix marriage.
Right.
Because a man has no rights in his house. The state actually owns your wife. Like, if your wife isn't strong in trusting you, and she could go to the state straight away and get the state to intervene.
Right.
A lot of women do that.
The state will enforce the will of the woman over the man.
And so the man doesn't really own his wife, and he knows it. He can feel that. It changes the dynamic of a relationship, because the man knows that he doesn't have full control anymore, that there's this government bearing over him, rather, but it should be God that's bearing over him. I don't know. I just don't see how you could fix it unless you change the whole society.
Well, we can't fix this. No, we never will fix this. Men will never fix this.
Right. I think the only thing we can do is turn our hearts back to him and try to live by his laws the best we can personally. Because, you know, we've talked to this before. The only person you can even attempt to change in this world ever is yourself.
Right.
You can't do it to your children or your wife or anyone else.
Right.
And that's what he said. If you turn your hearts to me, I will heal your nations. Right. So it's like, people were always looking at like, oh, I know so much about this. I know so much about scripture. I want to tell this guy and that guy and so forth. And we need to do that. But at the same time, we really need to concentrate on our own behavior, because that's what he wants. And that's what's the most important thing, I think. Because people are always saying, what can I do? What can I do? Like, white nationalists say that all the time. But I mean, they're not, I mean, that's where they have to begin. That's where we should begin.
Well, yeah, they should begin.
That's pretty much spelled out here in Ezekiel, in Ezekiel chapter 14. Though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, are in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness. In other words, they'll be powerless to help anybody else but themselves. Even Noah, Daniel, and Job. Ezekiel chapter 14, verses 14 and 20. Though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, as I live, saith Yahweh God, they shall deliver neither son nor daughter, but shall deliver their own souls by their righteousness.
Like, the first thing that white nationalists should do, if they want to change the world, is stop seeing prostitutes. Like, if David Duke would stop seeing prostitutes, that would be one big thing in putting down adultery. He would be taking a stand. He would be saying, I'm not standing for adultery anymore. I'm standing for my people and families and my race.
Yeah, and I mean, that's exactly what I mean. And it's little things too. Like, for example, usury, which has been talked about many times in Ezekiel. We should not put our money out to usury. We should not own interest-bearing investments. I mean, it's not like we can...
Investment in my life.
Yeah, and you're lucky, I know, that you do that. I won't do it, period. And I haven't done that since I became Christian Identity, because it's not worth it. I'm not gaining anything from it. I'm not going to gain anything. I'm going to lose a hell of a lot. And it's tough for people, because they look at it like, well, how can I fight inflation? And it's like, well, deal with it. Just fucking find another way. Go buy land. Go buy empty lots.
People right? say, like, how can Yahweh's law help us? And it's like, well, if we had the adultery laws, that would fix our society overnight, wouldn't it? Because you wouldn't have losers going around committing adultery and destroying marriage, like losers like David Duke and all the other losers who are white nationalists.
Well, Duke himself is a whore, so what's wrong with him sleeping with some whores? He's a whore.
Yeah, but if we wanted to heal our nation and restore the white race, all we'd have to do is keep the laws of Yahweh. And people say, how do the laws of the Bible fix anything? And it's like, it would. If you would stop being a scumbag today, we would start healing, manifesting the kingdom of God.
Right.
Yeah, but that was the speech I was going to give to the leader of the South, and they got a spick instead. So I
sorry, Bill. Man, does that suck. It's life, isn't it?
Sure.
Oh, well. It is, yeah.
It's their loss. I don't have to give anybody a speech. I mean, I don't live for
it
that.
It is their loss. They're going to go off in the trial. It is their loss. They're going to suffer for it.
You know what, Bill? You're probably one of the only people out there that ever did that, that bought investments that are interest-bearing, right? I mean, it's so rare, you know, especially in your 60 now, you still haven't, right? But that's like, it's got to be one in, I don't know, 500 guys these days. It's so rare. You know, it's something that everybody just takes for granted that you just have to do or else you're a dummy. And it's quite the opposite. It's actually exactly the opposite. You know, and we're trapped in this belief that there's no alternative. Well, the first thing is people should just sit there and think about it. Maybe give it a month or two and think about it every day for a while. And you'll see that there's many alternatives. There really are. And they're probably better. And you're probably going to make more money, to be honest.
You know what? Before I was CI, I would never buy stocks. I never owned a stock. I never owned a bond. I never had a 401c3 or what? No, an IRS 401k. That's what I'm looking for. I never had any of those things. When I lost my job as a correction sergeant, I got employed about 4 or 5 weeks later with a corporation as a technology manager, and they asked me to join a 401k, and I said, no, I don't want that. I don't want that. And they thought I was nuts.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's actually like peer pressure, like you're in high school. Everybody around you will think you're crazy, your coworkers, your friends, and your family. But ultimately, they're the ones who are crazy. We live in a crazy world where everybody just assumes that they need to fucking partake in usury or else.
They really thought I was crazy. And when I'd resign there, I didn't have to resign, but I did have to resign because I was under federal friggin' indictment. They offered me to move to Virginia with them. They offered me a $5,000 raise and I had to turn it down. But they when I resigned, they wrote me a check for what would have been their contributions to my 401k. So I got a check for like $4,000. Well, which I mean was pretty good, but I went and paid my lawyer bill with it. I mean, it went towards the legal bills, right? But they thought I was nuts for not joining that 401k. They really did.
Yeah, and there are a lot of things in life. I mean, there's basic things we need to change about, you know, the way we eat, what we eat, physical fitness. These are all things that Paul instructed us to treat our bodies like better than we are. We're not supposed to be alcoholics and all the rest of it, right? And it's there's a plethora of stuff that you can think of that we're doing that we should not be doing, generally speaking, and try to. It's not like you can change these things overnight, usually.
I agree.
I mean, going to Walmart is depressing. <You know?
laughs> I got to go once a month for paper towels and toilet paper.
Yeah, I go more than once a month, I got to admit.
It's about all we buy there for the most part. Maybe some pet food once in a while. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Joe.
You go ahead, Bill.
I was going to say Melissa gets most of the dog food delivered from Chewy's because it's actually cheaper than Walmart, and she doesn't have to go deal with the niggers. The day's coming though when the dogs might have to just go free range. I'm telling you, it's just kind of the free range.
Yeah. It's funny because they haven't been free range for like thousands of years.
Right.
All right, so do you want me to read chapter 24? It's kind of short, or you want to save it for next week?
It's up to y'all.
David?
Let's do it.
All right, we'll do it then. Chapter 24. Again, in the ninth year, in the tenth month, in the tenth day of the month, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, write thee the name of the day, even of this same day. The king of Babylon set himself against Jerusalem this day, and utter a parable unto the rebellious house, and say unto them, Thus saith Yahweh God, set on a pot, set it on, and also pour water into it. Gather the pieces thereof into it, even every good piece, the thigh and the shoulder, fill it with the choice bones. Take the choice of the flock, and burn also the bones under it, and make it boil well, and let them seethe the bones of it therein. Wherefore, thus saith Yahweh God, Woe to the bloody city, to the pot whose scum is therein, and whose scum is not gone out of it. Bring it out piece by piece, let no lot fall upon it. For her blood is in the midst of her. She set it upon the top of a rock. She poured it not upon the ground to cover it with dust, that it might cause fury to come up to take vengeance. I have set her blood upon the top of a rock, that it should not be covered. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh God, Woe to the bloody city. I will even make the pile for fire great. Heap on wood, kindle the fire, consume the flesh and spice it well, and let the bones be burned. Then set it empty upon the coals thereof, that the brass of it may be hot and may burn, and that the filthiness it may be molten in it, that the scum of it may be consumed.
That word spice is really to compound or to mix. I mean, it's not talking about the food, it's talking about the wood and the fire. To consume the flesh, not to add herbs and spices to it.
Yeah. Special herbs and spices.
Yeah. So this just describes what's about to happen in Jerusalem at the hand of the Babylonians.
Yeah, so they're gathering the pieces out of Jerusalem to boil the city.
Right. There's a 70 years prophecy in Jeremiah where the city would only lay desolate for 70 years after this. But I don't know if there's an equivalent prophecy to that in Ezekiel. I don't remember. Honest.
Well, how do you read? One,
we might not. I'm sorry?
Well, how do you read verse 7 where it says, Her blood is in the midst of her. She set it upon the top of a rock. She poured it not upon the ground to cover it with dust, that it might cause fury to come up to take vengeance. Is that something like the blood, you know, God's going to take vengeance against the blood because it wasn't covered with dust or something? I have set her blood upon the top of a rock that it should not be covered.
Yeah, I'm going to read the NAS.
So it's therefore, like her crimes.
Therefore, thus says Yahweh God, Woe to the bloody city, to the pot in which there is rust and whose rust has not gone out of it. Take out of it piece after piece without making a choice. Kind of weird. For her blood is in her midst. She placed it on the bare rock. She did not pour it on the ground to cover it with dust. That sounds like she was brazen. That she didn't even bother to hide her sins, her bloodshed, that she was brazen. And then it says that it may cause wrath to come up, take vengeance. I have put her blood on the bare rock that it may not be covered. So that kind of reverses the sense that we see in the King James translation. Yahweh put her blood on the bare rock that it may not be covered, so that wrath would come up to take vengeance.
Yeah, so she's going to pay for her sins.
Yes. That's how the NAS reads. New American Standard Version. I mean, I could read the Septuagint.
Um,
Brent and Sethrogen, for her blood is in the midst of her. I have set it upon a smooth rock. I have not poured it out upon the earth so that the earth should cover it. That makes more sense, that my wrath should come up for complete vengeance to be taken. I set her blood upon a smooth rock so as not to cover it. So
Yahweh is not covering her sins.
Yeah, and in Ezekiel 24:7 in the King James, it says, she poured it not upon the ground. But in the Septuagint, it says, I have not poured it upon the earth. So that's a significant difference. I'm looking for the Hebrew.
That is, yeah. It's verse 8, isn't it?
Verse 7, and set upon the Masoretic text does have a third person verb. She did not pour it. But the Septuagint has a first person verb. I did not pour it. And I did not pour it makes a hell of a lot more sense. In other words, Yahweh wouldn't let Judah cover her sins, right? He wouldn't let them cover their sins. He laid them bare for all to see so that he could take vengeance upon them, is what I believe is being said there. So we have a first person verb in the Septuagint, where we have a third person verb in the feminine verb in the King James Version and the NAS. But even with that, the NAS has a better sense of what the verb, of what the passage means. If that verb is a first person verb, as it is in the Septuagint, it agrees better with verse 8, where it says, I have put her blood on the bare rock. So we have a difference in the verbs between the Greek and the Hebrew. The Septuagint verbs are all first person verbs in 24:7 and 24:8. I have set it upon a smooth rock. I have not poured it out in 24:7.
It seems like they're both viable. Like it could be that she's arrogant and she's not covering her sin. She's arrogantly sinning. Or it could be that Yahweh is not going to have mercy and cover her sins. He's holding her to account.
Right. And that's what I'm leaning towards. I'm leaning towards the Septuagint renderings. I really am. I mean, it would make for an interesting commentary someday when I'm about 83, maybe. I might have time for Ezekiel.
You might get there.
I guess. I don't know.
Well, I'll finish this chapter then with that comment. And she hath wearied herself with lies, and her great scum went not forth out of her. Her scum shall be in the fire. In thy filthiness is lewdness, because I have purged thee, and thou wast not purged. Thou shalt not be purged from thy filthiness any more, till I have caused my fury to rest upon thee. I, Yahweh, have spoken it. It shall come to pass, and I will do it. I will not go back, neither will I spare, neither will I repent according to thy ways and according to thy doings. Shall they judge thee, saith Yahweh God. Also the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, behold, I take away from thee the desire of thine eyes with a stroke, yet neither shalt thou mourn nor weep, neither shall thy tears run down. Forbear to cry, make no mourning for the dead. Bind the tire of thine head upon thee, and put on thy shoes upon thy feet, and cover not thy lips, and eat not the bread of men. So I spake unto the people in the morning, and at even my wife died, and I did in the morning as I was commanded. And the people said unto me, Wilt thou not tell us what these things are to us, that thou doest so? Then I answered them, The word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Speak unto the house of Israel, thus saith Yahweh God, Behold, I will profane my sanctuary, the excellency of your strength, the desire of your eyes, and that which your soul pitieth, and your sons and your daughters whom ye have left shall fall by the sword, and ye shall do as I have done. Ye shall not cover your lips, nor eat the bread of men. And your tire shall be upon your head, and your shoes upon your feet. Ye shall not mourn nor weep, but ye shall pine away for your iniquities, and mourn one toward another. Thus Ezekiel is unto you a sign. According to all that he hath done, shall ye do. And when this cometh, ye shall know that I am Yahweh God. Also thou, son of man, shall it be in the day when I take from them their strength, the joy of their glory, the desire of their eyes, and that whereupon they set their minds, their sons and their daughters, that he that escapeth in the day shall come unto thee, to cause thee to hear it with thine ears. In that day shall thy mouth be open to him which is escaped, and thou shalt speak, and be no more dumb, and thou shalt be a sign unto them, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. End of chapter 24.
Okay, I mean, it's a pretty strong admonition, but
so what, the temple's been destroyed and they're not going to cry or mourn? The desire of their eyes. I will profane my sanctuary, the excellency of your strength, the desire of your eyes, and that which your soul pitieth.
That word tires is really probably headdresses or turbans or bonnets if they're women, or and your shoes upon your feet. You shall not mourn nor weep, but ye shall pine away for your iniquities and mourn one toward another. It's kind of weird too. That's like, and your turbans will be upon your heads and your shoes upon your feet. You will not mourn and you will not weep, but you will rot away in your iniquities and you will groan to one another. They will rot away in their iniquities and they will complain to one another. That word for mourn, the first word is to wail or lament. And then what the King James has, and mourn one toward another, it's to growl or to groan. It's a very poor translation. That word should not have been translated as mourn because it causes confusion and it seems to be in conflict. So instead of mourning for what's happened to them, they're just going to pine away for their iniquities and bitch about it, complain about it to each other.
And so this is the same day his wife dies. So his wife died that same evening.
Right.
And he's not going to mourn, and ye shall not cover your lips nor eat the bread of men. It's so,
And that's exemplary of what happened with Hosea. It's the same thing. He was told to marry a whore and have babies with her, right? That's exemplary of Judah being dead in the eyes of Yahweh.
So what's it mean when you don't eat the bread of men and you don't cover your lips, Bill?
Figurative bread, like a metaphor.
Yeah, it must have some relation to mourning or what. they had done when they lost a loved one.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. When a loved one dies, other people in the community would make your meals for you. So in the morning, that would be the bread of mourning.
I can imagine that.
Or eat the bread of men.
I don't know. I read it because it's saying you shall not cover your lips, so you will not cease to speak what I'm saying that you should say, and nor eat the bread of men, meaning the opposite of the bread of Christ, for example.
It says, "And cover not thy lips," meaning don't maintain your silence with this message that you're given.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And then it's followed up by "nor eat the bread of men." I don't think it's about eating, physically eating. It's about accepting their bullshit.
Well, maybe it's what Bill means, like, don't even eat, don't do anything until you've given this message. You won't have time to mourn, I guess.
Yeah, well, when his wife died, the people said unto me, "Wilt thou not tell us what these things are to us, that thou doest so?" Because he evidently refused their bread and didn't cover his lips. In other words, he wasn't humbled and silent at the death of his wife. So the people asked him what's going on, and that's when he told them. And the word of Yahweh came unto me saying, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and I think that if he had been humble and silent at the death of his wife, that would be equivalent to eating the bread of men.
To be comforted by the people instead of what his role was to discomfort the people.
Yeah. And I just think that eating the bread of men would be being comforted by them.
Yeah, he was told to reject their comfort. Don't eat the bread of men.
Yeah.
There will be no comfort.
Because I'm sure it was hard for Ezekiel to lose his wife. But his wife was probably spared what was going to happen. For real.
Right.
And the rest of the community saw what happened to Ezekiel. And they were like, thus, what happens to Ezekiel is what's going to happen to you. I think that might be it.
Yeah, right.
And those that take heed will escape and they'll come back to with open ears.
Yeah, the prophets didn't have it easy, right? Jeremiah ended up in prison. Ezekiel, he lost his wife here. A lot of guys might think Hosea had it made. He was told to find a whore and marry her and have kids with her. But he was probably miserable too.
I'm sure he would have been.
Being married to a whore.
You keep bringing up that example, but I don't think I'd want that. That's not the best. I don't know which one prophet I would pick. I don't think he had it the best though. Ezekiel had it pretty bad. They all had it pretty bad.
Yeah, I'm sure. Daniel ended up in a furnace.
Joshua?
Daniel.
Yeah, I mean, Joshua ended up all right. I mean, he had some fun. He had some good times. Maybe like Samson, like just have a good time and then at the end, you know, die young. That worked out. That was all right.
But he wasn't a prophet, though, right? But I mean, among the prophets, Elijah had a pretty good ending.
Elijah. Was he the one that was called up?
They were chasing him for years to kill him.
In a whirlwind.
Yeah, and he, and sort of Elisha, too. He died in an old age. But he got to kick some ass, you know. in his lifetime. Both of them did.
Yeah, I
the
guess
only prophet that had it really made was Solomon.
Yeah.
And yep. He abused it. He screwed it all up.
Yeah, I think that's a lesson, though, too, for us, right? Because no matter, even if you're the wisest man who's ever lived, yep. You're still susceptible to becoming a
total fuck up.
Yeah.
I agree. I would have you agree.
Who are you calling a total fuck up? Because, I mean, Solomon was more successful than any of us here.
Yeah, but not at the end.
Oh, success came from God. It wasn't on his own accord. He was given everything by Yahweh. It wasn't on his own accord. I mean, he was humble enough early in life to ask for wisdom, but then he went and had 900 whores for wives.
How wise can he really be?
Yeah.
Well, he let it go to his head, right? Because he entered into sin purposely to experience it, thinking that he was not going to, like, he was infallible.
Yep. Yeah, that's what he said in Ecclesiastes, that he did it on purpose.
Yeah, but then he found out that he wasn't infallible. I'm guessing he knew that by the time he died. Who knows? But he was building monuments to fucking Moloch and other goofy gods at that point.
When he first started drinking every day, he probably thought it was a genius idea. And then as the days went on, he started to realize, I guess.
Yeah.
He thought he could handle it at first. I'm King Solomon, the wisest king ever. And then it's going to his head and he's starting to, I can imagine, maybe something like that.
Yeah, you wake up in the morning, you have 900 wives.
What a zapper, dear.
How the fuck does that even happen? Like, one is fine. I'm good with one.
Yeah, exactly. The king's advisors would have just been like, what has happened here? You've totally... And that's when he wrote Ecclesiastes in the days after, he was just so full of regret.
Yeah, it seems that Ecclesiastes is his effort towards repentance. So at least he took accountability for his sin. He said he did it on purpose. At least he admitted culpability.
Yeah, he didn't try and blame it on God.
Or on one of his wives.
Like that would have been the smart move.
Yeah, I'll probably talk about that tomorrow or Friday. Friday, I started writing today. I only wrote one page today, but it's the important part. It's the introduction, I think. I'll be writing all day tomorrow.
All right, should I cut the recording?
Yeah, we could have done that.